The subject is quantum gravity. These are some of the issues I will talk about. Should we quantize gravity? Is renormalization necessary for QFT? So ultraviolet complete electric weak model without a Higgs particle. Can particle physics and gravity exhibit non-local effects? UV complete quantum gravity, cosmological constant form, and I'll end with, if I have time, with consequences for black holes and cosmology in UV complete quantum gravity. So let's start with item number one. It's a long history. We go back to the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And there was the pioneer work of Bryce DeWitt in the early 60s with Richard Feynman, who went to Poland for a conference, published his famous paper on astrophysical barometer, 64. And by the way, he wrote his wife to say he would never go back to one of these quantum gravity meetings, which in fact he did, it turned out later. And then we move on to canonical quantum gravity, all the work by Peter Bergman, collaborators at Syracuse, etc., etc. And then string theory happened, and string theory claimed that this is the only way to do quantum gravity. You get a finite quantum gravity theory. Of course, in those days, they were into a theory of everything, the tau. Then we have loop quantum gravity, the work of Lee Sloan and collaborators from Valley. We move on. In 2000, I published a paper on non-commutative quantum gravity, so we have lots of papers on that subject. Starting with the work of Snyder, who was a student of Oppenheimer back in the 40s. And then we have the latest giving up Lorentz invariants so that the loop integrals and quantum gravity calculations are power counting finite, so-called Harada gravity, which I actually in 1992-93 published papers on spontaneous interpretation of Lorentz invariants and did three-dimensional gravity. I knew about dimensional regularization, so it's such a non-relativistic scheme where you separate space and time, you get a theory, a renormalizable theory. I didn't like it because I was going to have to start doing quantum field theory calculations with non-relativistic propagators, which I found rather very ugly. Anyway, I haven't changed my mind on that. So, we all know that quantum gravity, if you expand around a fixed background, is not renormalizable. Famous paper by Tooft and Veltman, 1967. Further work by Deza and Niedermoisen. And the bottom line is, if you interact gravity with matter, then it's not renormalized to any order. So, should we quantize gravity? Well, if we write down Einstein's field equations, and we take the expectation value of the angular momentum tensor, then since 1900, Max Planck, we know that matter has to be treated in a quantum physical way, quantum physics. And nature likes to have a situation where if you have a reaction, you have a back reaction, Newton's third law, Okay, so you expect to have some quantum physics going on the left hand side. Can we just use quantum size fields in a curved background? Can we use a quantum field in a classical background? And I would say no, but this is still controversial. One of the problems we have doing quantum gravity over all these years is that there's no definite quantum gravity experimental data. There's no smoking gun. We are looking for it. Conferences are being held to do phenomenological quantum gravity to see if there's some way of extracting quantum gravity data from nature experimentally. So far, I haven't seen it. But, however, quantum gravity, as I will discuss, could have an effect in solving the infamous cosmological constant problem, the mother of all hierarchy problems. And it has consequences for black holes and cosmology in this scheme that I'm going to present. Okay, so I'm going to assume that we do have quantum gravity. And we come to renormalization. Is renormalization theory necessary for QFT? Well, we have to link all of quantum field theory together with quantum gravity. Because in the electroweak model, we were electroweak, standard model. With a Higgs particle, the theory is renormalized. This is a famous paper by Tuft in the 70s, Tuft and Velkin. However, it depends on having a Higgs particle and a Higgs field. A Higgs field is like an ether. It permeates all the space-time. And it sticks to particles and gives them mass. So you start with a phase in the early universe where all the masses of all elementary particles are zero. And then you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking from the mixture to half potential. And you get a false vacuum, and it's all based on having this is a V of phi versus the scalar field phi, which has spin zero, the particle spin zero, the positive parity, and therefore has a particle with those quantum numbers. And it's based on having this kind of potential for the phi field, scalar field. And we assume that mu squared can be negative, lambda has to be positive, and you get a Higgs mechanism. There's a phase in the early universe when there's this spontaneous symmetry breaking occurring, and particles like the W and the Z obtain their mass through the vacuum expectation value of this scalar field. And the fermions obtain their mass through your power. However, if you add, if you use up the gradient potential like this, the theories are all very normalizable. So there's something somewhat ad hoc about the situation. There's no fundamental explanation for why mu squared can be negative. And of course, anything other than that, any polynomial on phi bigger than fourth power, theories are only normalizable. Most quantum field theories are not only normalizable. So in the 70s, early 70s, renormalizability was a criterion for doing particle physics. If the theory isn't renormalizable, then you can't use it. And I think this position has been, it's not treated as favorable as it used to be three decades ago or more. Even by Steven Weinberg and Lucy Fox, seems to be not favoring such a strict point of view in doing particle physics. Now, just a few words about electroweak theory. It turns out that if you calculate spanning aperture for longitudinally polarized WW scattering, you get G squared stuff in here. And what you do is you calculate find that when you work out these tree graphs, a lot of bad energy behavior gets cancelled because of the group structure of the electroweak model. It's called the gauge structure. However, you still get this left over. S is the square of the center of mass energy. And MW is the mass of the W pipe, which is not quite accurate. This is bad news. It's all done at the perturbative level. And these are all tree graph contributions. However, if you add in the Higgs exchange, it cancels this bad behavior. This is the critical part of electroweak theory. And it's linked with the fact that the theories are normalizable. Because when you add in the Higgs exchange, this is the minimal model of a neutral Higgs particle, then the theories are normalizable. Okay. When you, in the, I have a, I should refer to a paper by myself. It's on the head page. Where it's, I think it's the most complete calculation of all of this. Also, U plus, U minus, going into W plus, W minus. It's a complete calculation of everything. And this is critical. So, how do we resolve this problem without renormalization theory? If you can't resolve it without renormalization theory, then unless you give up contribution theory, unless you start saying that electroweak theory, the standard model, has to become non-perturbative, then you have to really buy into the normalization theory. So, starting about in 1990, I published papers in Physical Review on the non-local quantum field theory. And I'll discuss the conclusions reached on this. Up till the, I published in the 1991 a paper on literally model without a Higgs boson. At this time, I quit thinking about it because I thought it's going to be 20 or 30 years before we can decide whether Higgs boson exists. There's no point working on this until we know. We're getting closer to knowing whether the Higgs boson exists or not. I don't want to spend time in an experimental situation, but we're getting there. Within a year or two, we should know between 150 GeV and 200 GeV. From experiments of the tetratron and LHC. Okay, so I just built these scenarios to see how far I could get with our renormalization theory, whether I could construct an electrically model without a Higgs particle. This is very relevant to quantum gravity. So the most recent paper I have is with it's this one here, and that one, number four, and number seven. Number four is on archives, and I construct an electric weak model without a Higgs boson. Now.
Can I
have
a question?
Yes.
So I don't know much about particle physics, but I have the impression that we need the Higgs particle to give mass to the gauge bosons.
That what?
We need the Higgs particle to give a mass to the gauge bosons. So how do you give mass to the gauge bosons if you don't have any Higgs particle?
I don't have a Higgs, so I don't have to worry about giving it a mass.
No, no, the gauge bosons, the W
the
and
gauge,
the Z.
The gauge, the W and the Z. Okay, well, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but since you asked the question.
Let's move on.
So,
and maybe come back to the after that.
The trouble is, there's a lot of information going on here to get to where I'm going, and we have to sort of skip it. Some of it. It seems to have a life of its own.
It needs an eraser. Put an eraser on the.
Ah, good. All right, so. What I'm going to do is say the following, that root g of x is equal to root g newton times curly f of box over lambda g squared. I'm making, I can sit on it maybe. Here, box is equal to g mu nu l nu l nu equals 1 over root minus g d nu root minus g g nu nu d nu is the covariant derivative operator in a Riemannian geometry, pseudo-Riemannian geometry. And curly f equals an entire function. Entire function is a holomorphic function which has no poles in the finite complex plane. It has to have a pole or essential singularity at infinity by what's called Liouville's theorem, otherwise it's a constant. And consequence of this is that when I calculate a quantum loop graph, this is a graviton.
Can you present why this would be your original equation?
Sorry.
How do you put your root g of x in the original equation?
What is the problem?
So is this proposal that you take the Einstein branch and everywhere you see square root of g, you replace it?
I'm getting that. That's right. So the Einstein Lagrangian equals and lambda is the cosmological constant, R is the Fitch scale. So this is a scalar tensor gravity, Lagrangian. And when we do a Fourier transform.
Yeah, but now where is the G of something from? So G is an operator, you know. So you have to tell me your kind of spinning in the action. You cannot have one of a box acting on R, for instance. So you're meaning something else.
What?
Well, that's what I'm asking. What are
you okay, doing? So what happens is that you can prove that the entire function is a function of this box. For example, it could be e to the fox x over lambda g squared. Then when you do the variational principle on this Lagrangian, this is not the variation of the action. If you do the variational principle on this action, don't get out.
I mean, you might not mean that one over g is in front of the action, because exponential minus box, a box below an integral, I can integrate by part and give me zero. So if you write it like that, then g, you know, there's no effect on this entire function.
What happens is if you...
So if you're meaning something specific. I'm just saying, if you put exponential minus box x instead of gx there, then it doesn't depend on this box.
If you do the variation with respect to g, it depends on g and u. Delta s delta g and u gives you a
I'm just saying the integral of box and something is equal
so
to
what,
zero.
The fifth equation you get is that g and u equals 8 pi gn times Fourier squared. Times T n, which is equal to
but John, what Laurent is saying is that the way you've defined box, it's one over root g times the total derivative of something. So since you're multiplying root g in there, the root g's will cancel, and you'll find box acting on anything is the total derivative of whatever it's acting on, and therefore you can integrate it by parts to zero, that's what you're saying, basically, right?
Yeah.
And no matter how many boxes you have, that's going to happen. So that's, I think, the question that's
going to be the question is that that's not correct.
How is that avoided?
You mean something else.
Yeah.
So
that's
what you find is...
So I'm just saying that this doesn't mean anything.
When you do the variational derivative, the variational principle calculation, you get surface contributions. But because you have the entire function of this form, there are surface contributions, so they don't contribute to the actual fifth equation at the end. And this is what you find. I have the proof, which I don't have time to give, but if you're interested, I can give it to you.
Can I ask a question on notation? Just if the g of x is the square root of g mu times the entire function?
Yeah, it should be, yeah.
So,
it's
So it's not, because what I thought you meant, you would say is just correct the square root of g. So it's not itself the square root of g. So it's not, you're not multiplying the square root of g times the entire function. You're replacing the square root of g times the entire function.
Yeah, there's a 2 in the denominator.
So this, unless I'm wrong, this is not a density. So this is not a density on holomorphism. This is a determinant of the square root of the term of the metric transformed by the density on a different morphism. Does your new object transform by the density?
This is a non-local statement.
So I certainly recognize
that. This is a differential operator.
It still has a transformation property under the homomorphism.
Yeah.
So it has a transformation property as a density.
Well, it's a scalar. It's a scalar differential operator. Which is.
Right, so if it doesn't, then the gauge invariance of the action is no longer space-time diffeomorphic.
We're getting to that.
Okay.
So what happens is that, I'm just giving you the result, that we have the root minus g, g of x in here, or p squared.
John, I'm sorry, this formula doesn't make any sense. So maybe what you mean is that R, let me try to make sense. R is d gamma plus gamma gamma, right?
R is g mu, so R mu.
R is d gamma plus gamma gamma, gamma is the connection. So maybe if you rescale the metric, you can put g, so d gamma, let's say, you know, it drops out, and I have like usually a square root of g gamma times square root of g gamma. Yeah. So what you mean is that square root of g is acting on gamma, and then you square that. Is that what you mean? You said that gamma is not a tensor. Because otherwise this factor, the thing is that if you write it like that, what I'm saying is that there is no dependence in your parameter lambda g. If you write it, because you can integrate by parts. That's what I'm saying. You see what I'm saying? If I put expansion of box on.
I have a PDF which gives every single line of the calculation.
If you want me to do it,
I can do it on the blackboard, but we don't have time. And it's been checked by several of us, including Pierre.
I'm just asking what is the definition of the theory?
Yeah, but you have to do the calculation.
The definition is the calculation.
I'll show you later. Okay, so the story is that the curl F goes into curl F of P squared of the lambda G squared. Okay, by Fourier transform. So, when you calculate the Racket polarization, I can show you here. If you work out the Racket polarization, calculation is pi mu, rho sigma. Four suffixes, then it's finite, and all loop graphs are finite. Also, now you have to ask the question, gauge invariance. So the theory, what about the theory has to be?
Excuse me, John, before we talk about gauge invariance, just to address the boxes issue, is your modification equivalent to saying you take the propagator and everywhere you see in the propagator 1 over p squared, you multiply that by f of p squared, so now it's 1 over p squared, f of p squared, and that's what the proposal is.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So in all the vertex functions, the vertex functions run as the entire function runs from phi squared. And the entire functions, so you can't write in unitarity because you get no bad physical poles anyway.
So you modify the propagator, maybe can you just write that formula? You modify the propagators and the vertices or just the propagators?
Okay, so if you look in here, this is the lowest order grounds in the ground and self energy calculation. And this is your entire function. And this is the propagator. This is the one you choose when you fix the gauge in the action.
The question is whether you also modify the vertices.
So it turns out that in the loop calculation for this order, you can either put this entire function associated with the propagator or with the vertex. You can't tell the difference because they always come in pairs. But I prefer to stick to it being a vertex function because then my propagator is the usual point particle, like the causal propagator.
So, fine. So, if you modify the propagator, the vertices are not the
propagator. Stay as the usual, root g Newton.
Okay. If you modify the vertices but not the propagators, it's as if you're modifying the g Newton. Is that a fair statement? In other words, g Newton rather than being a constant is now g Newton times this entire function of the
That's right. You have a choice.
No, I don't want a choice. I want to do one thing.
Okay.
Because I want to understand it and I'm not understanding. Your proposal, because this is a proposal, it's not for argument, which is fine. Your proposal is write the finding rules for general relativity, expand around flat space-time. Everywhere you see G Newton, write G Newton 0 times e to the box or e to the minus p squared over lambda.
Yep.
That's the proposal.
That's it.
Oh, but that's not exactly the same as this one. Because this one, you will have new interaction vertices coming up from the because the box of G contains p squared, but it contains higher order term.
No, but we never truncate the entire function. You mustn't do that.
I'm not truncating the entire function. But box is p squared plus terms which depends on the graviton. Right? It's a nonlinear function of the graviton. It depends on the metric. So.
So this
proposal cannot do the same thing as these finite rules.
Right, so I'm happy whatever to take, is this proposal. I'm happy to take this proposal for modifying the finite rules as the proposal because it's not obviously equivalent to something which is trivial, which we're having trouble understanding the Lagrangian. But okay, so that's the proposal.
Yeah. So there it is. Let's see. So this is the interpolated field, the density, contributed density. This is exact the statement of this one. And then you expand this, the covariant. This is the Lagrangian expanded in the root g. And this is what you get when you expand L1, L2, and L0. And the fundamental question is, can you construct a non-local quantum theory like this, which is gauge invariant to all orders?
So that root g is that function, and not just Newton's, that root capital G.
Yeah.
That's not just Newton's constant, it's that function.
So in 1991...
But are you saying it's just a field definition of gap, which you call the gamma minimum? If I define a new gamma mu to be square root g times gamma mu, I have the usual gravity.
It looks that way.
This is work based on others. In fact, it's based on papers by Kappa, Leibrand, George Leibrand, who used to be here. Medrano. There's all sorts of people.
We're
going back to the early 70s.
We just want to understand. So the proposal is that geometry of space-time is modified in a universal way, which can be equivalent to, after you scale the g-units out of the Feynman rules, that the propagator is not dependent on g-units, and only vertices with n particles are multiplied by n to the minus 2 over 2 powers of g-newton, then multiply g-newton times a function of the momentum going through the vertex, presumably symmetrized in some way. Okay. And this is a proposal for how to replace local quantum field theory by a slightly nominal
field
theory. Right, so I recognize the idea is Salam and strategy played around with something like that. And, okay. Good. Okay. So then the issue, so then I agree with you. The next issue is have you messed up different morphism invariants, which is the gauge invariant.
Yeah, the different morphism invariants is a local gauge invariant. So, given here. You have to put in ghost fields, you have to construct a Lagrangian with ghost fields, you have to do fairly Popoff, you have to put in a gauge fixing, da-da-da, all this stuff goes into the action in order to make the thing so consistent. And this, I use this path integral here to do the quantum field theory calculations. All standard stuff. I can get all the Feynman graphs by iterating this, provided I know the measure for the metric.
Okay, so now, to understand the issue of gauge invariance, let's consider the three-point vertex. So the three-point vertex is now multiplied, so maybe could you draw it, please?
So on this particular, the three graphs, which are all classical, I strip, when I do my gauge transformations, I find, of course, that when I have this non-local vertex function, or if the propagator has a non-local numerator, a time function numerator, you break gauge invariance. This has been the crucial question. So in 1991, Richard Woodard, in fact, was here, and myself and two students published a long paper in Physical Review where we did QED completely with this formalism. And we proved that gauge invariance can be valid to all orders, and that it's unitary to all orders, and it's finite to all orders. And the way we did it was to, at each stage of the expansion of the fields, we put in a restoring term in the Lagrangian, which restores the gauge invariance to that order. And you keep doing this to all orders. And we actually were able to, for QED, to prove an exact result in the paper. You sum it all up, you get gauge invariance exactly to all orders. This is a very important result, because otherwise none of this goes.
You said unitarity as well. Did you mean in the S matrix?
Or in the S matrix.
Or Hamiltonian evolution? Or do you
not? Well, when you do scattering apertures, you're calculating the S matrix.
Yes, okay.
So, because it's an entire function, you can prove that you never violate unitarity. You get the Kurkowski rules at all orders in the absorptive part of the amplitude. And the same goes through for quantum gravity. My student, former student in Cornish, who now does gravitational waves, published papers doing the quantum gravity gauge calculations to all orders. Same thing. So that's established. So now we have a quantum gravity theory, which is expanded about a fixed background. It could be Minkowski space or De Sitter, whatever you want. Minkowski, of course, is the easiest. And the theory is gauge invariant to all orders, unitary to all orders, and finite to all orders.
So Just to back up, John, let me ask you a much simpler question. Look at the 3-point vertex among gravitons. Okay. So that has three momenta, p, q, and r.
Right.
And so that is now multiplied by some function, e to the minus p squared plus e to the minus q squared plus e to the minus r squared. Okay. Are those squares with respect to the background Minkowski metric, or are there other graviton terms in the exponential?
Okay, well, this is an important point. That when you do the gauge transformations, you use this operator curly O. This was done by Richard Wood and myself back in 91. You use this operator, and what it does is that when you do the calculation of Compton scattering, the entire functions are stripped away. So all the tree graphs are point-like and local, as in standard Feynman theory. Only the loop graphs are non-local. Loop graphs are the quantum part of the theory. Tree graphs are classical.
Look, I'm worried about the integral. So once again, is it multiplied by e to the minus p squared plus r squared?
Yeah.
No matter how that is embedded, or there are extra. When in the box, is the box a flat space box, or is it a curved space box expanding around flat space?
Well, we do. The box is treated as a flat space.
Okay, then how can it be diffeomorphism?
It's not. As soon as you start expanding around a fixed factor, in a sense, you've already lost a manifest diffeomorphism.
No. Tufton, Veltman, and other people taught us how to expand around a flat background and maintain the consequences of diffeomorphism invariance order by order and perturbation theory. If you have in the definition of your quantum dynamics of your Feynman rules additional pieces that break gauge
invariance,
then you have to worry that those don't. So, for example, consequences of gauge invariance are the property of the S matrix only box in two and doesn't box in one in zero. And John, you know this as well as I do. If you just arbitrarily break gauge invariance inside the Feynman rules, you're going to be able to make diagrams which propagate spin zero and spin one.
Well, the proof of the gauge invariance is done without choosing a specific entire function. All I know is that it's a function of the box, the Gournay box. So all of that goes through proving gauge invariance. But then when I do a calculation to lowest order, life is hard enough in gravity. So I make the assumption that the box is flat space to do a backward position. But only at the end. Okay.
But to just the lowest order.
That's only to lowest order. But the rest is rigorous, that you're using the covariant box when you prove gauge invariance. As you can see it on this slide, I don't like the gauge invariance is proved without choosing a specific entire function. So, okay. So I have to move on.
I'm sorry, but for me the original definition is still not clear, John. So
what is not clear?
What theory you're talking about? Here you just say at first order you do that, fine. You put exponential p, but I'm talking full order. So you claim that you have a full order theory. Can you just define it? Give me the definition so that then I can verify that it's defined by it. So what's the definition of theory? Not perturbative at one order. So can you just...
What do you mean by definition?
Definition?
Of what?
Of your theory.
I gave it to you.
No.
I didn't.
No.
Why?
So where is it? Give it to me again.
I've written down an action, okay?
No, but I'm saying the action, the g of x disappeared. So in the thing you wrote to me, I can replace g of x by g newton, right? So I have an equality.
Yeah.
Are you saying this because
You can expand out the exponential.
Yes, you can
every term, but yes, the first one will reduce to a total divergence.
Exactly.
We couldn't. If the expansion were not correct, didn't converge or something like that.
Let's take the exponential. Let's take the exponential.
Yeah.
I expand the exponential there. Yeah. Every term except the first one gives me zero.
Or a boundary.
Every term is a total derivative. That's his concern.
Yeah.
Except for the first one. It's 1 plus d mu of stuff.
Yeah, but according to the exponential, then you would...
It doesn't matter.
No, it wouldn't matter what it is.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's any power series.
Yeah, but how do we know that those functions...
Doesn't matter what function it is.
Right, it's a
function
of time.
And if that function is something,
no, it's because the thing it's a function of is a total derivative operator.
But only because it's an entire function of that.
Well, I guess you can even generalize.
It
doesn't matter.
Any coefficients I want.
But anyway, suppose you get, even Bagration, suppose you get expand. So then, I'm sure.
You I have to show you the proof, so we can talk about it then. We worried a lot about
this. I don't want a proof, I want a definition. You see, a definition. I don't require any proof here.
Okay, well, the fact that this is the action and the proof follows when you do the variational principle calculation. Anyway, let's move on. Let's do black holes. Okay, so. These are the field equations, okay, where S mean mu is given here. And this S mean mu is modified in general tensor is covariant conserved because of the Einstein tensor. We choose T naught naught to be a plotted function.
What about the variation of F?
That is part of my PDF, which I will show you. A detailed calculation. If you can find something wrong with that, fine. But I don't find anything wrong with it. Now, so you write down the static spherical-symmetric solution, and you find that because of the modified Angelou-Rentzen tensor.
Sorry, I'm still thinking about the is your claim that there's no factor ordering ambiguity in this? So in other words, no matter where you insert
what you find
the
is
G, it doesn't make any difference. To
what you find is that you do get total derivative terms, but what's left over is the field equation. These total derivative terms become surface terms, so they go away. That's what you actually find when you do the calculation in detail.
So the claim is, it doesn't matter where you put the G. Over
other people have done.
You
people
put
have the non-commutative quantum gravity. They all do this. This is not new, by the way. We refer to papers by Leonardo and collaborators. Okay, so we have this S naught naught, and we do a Fourier transform. You put in this F here, and you do the calculation, and you find that in the static spherical symmetric solution, you have a modified G of R, and you end up with a black hole which is just sitting inside, no singularity. And this extremal black hole, it has two horizons. You get a Penrose diagram like this, a string of black hole. Only with mass, there's no electric charge in this one. And we investigated, this is the work done with Leonardo and Piero Nicolini. We have a preprint on the archives. So, when we calculate the entropy at zero, and the temperature goes to zero, so the remnant zero temperature and zero entropy. And this, one can argue that this gets rid of the information loss paradox. If you refer to Giddings' talk from yesterday, he said that what we may have to drop the concept of locality in quantum field theory and general relativity in order to solve the information loss paradox.
But wait, I'm confused about that point, because your non-locality comes in its own characteristic distance scale, right?
Yes.
So if we have a black hole that's a lot bigger than that distance scale, we're still going to have the information being lost until the black hole gets to the characteristic scale of non-locality, right?
Yeah, but this is what happens at the horizon, supposedly, at the horizon. This is why he said, Giddings, that we may need new physics when we at the horizon.
But he meant the horizon length scale. So I suppose that the black hole is a solar mass black hole, mm-hmm. and this is at the electroweak scale non-locality. How is that going to have information coming out of the solar mass black hole?
Well, because the idea is that the point of gravity kicks in at the surface. Okay.
Yeah, it's the surface of a solar mass black hole. So I'm not sure I understand. I thought it kicked in at a tiny scale, and he's saying...
Well, it's kicking in, sorry, it kicks in... What's happening is, his analogy with the atom, hydrogen atom, right? There's a singularity from classical physics, and you spiral in towards a singularity. So in this case, the black hole is a singularity in standard calculation, and you want to prevent something falling into the singularity. So this is what this is doing. As you approach the singularity, the non-locality has removed the singularity. You said that the sitter space inside.
Well, yeah, but he's talking about information loss, that if you have a giant black hole.
The whole issue of, I was afraid to talk about the information loss paradox because it's a jungle. Everybody disagrees with it. A lot of people disagree with what's going on. Some people claim there's a paradox, other people don't, and blah, blah. String theories claim there isn't, some string theories claim there is. And I don't want to get into that at the moment. This is what we find. Now, for the cosmology...
But you just, what you find is a deviation from structure, no matter how big the black hole is. And inside the horizon, can you just repeat? Inside the horizon, it's completely different from what classical ordinary relativity would say.
Yes.
Ordinary shape. So in the process of formation of the black hole, there has to be an order one deviation from what the Einstein equations would have told us.
So the non-length
scales comparable to the horizon.
The non-locality kicks in as you try to get to the singularity.
No, the horizon forms long.
If we go to the field equations, the same thing happens, let's look at the Okay, so here. We're just talking about classical general relativity with a modification, and we don't have to worry about the issue we were talking about before. So on the second line is the ordinary Einstein equations on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, is we just take the energy momentum tensor of matter, and we smear it out. That's correct. Let's go down, and that still satisfies the conservation law.
That's right.
Okay. Let's go down one step, okay? Then, of course, if there was vacuum on the right-hand side, nothing would be changed.
That's right.
But then we can make a black hole.
No, because now the claim is that you should really study the situation where the source is a delta function at the origin.
Correct.
But why should we study that?
Because the principle we can follow. I understand why you're saying what you're saying, but let's just follow and see where it goes. Okay. So the claim is let's take why study. Imagine that we were studying a ball of matter and we're shrinking the ball, and then there would be, and we might consider the Schwarzschild as a limit of a solution where there was a matter interior, and we're just shrinking down the matter interior for convenience. So, and let's just think because of the smearing out on the right-hand side, that's going to give a different answer than it used to. Okay, so that gives something which is called a modified Schwarzschild. Okay, and where the modification has happened is in a little region of scale. There's a scale somewhere of lambda g, of lambda around r equals 0.
Is that right?
Yes.
Outside of that, it looks like regular Schwarzschild.
Yes.
It doesn't look like decision. Oh, I thought you said it looked like decision.
Inside the black hole.
Inside the horizon or
inside
the special radius?
Inside both horizons.
As soon as you cross the horizon, it looks like decision.
There's two
instead of
Schwarzschild.
Well, you have to be careful because you have an inner and outer horizon. So
the outer
horizon. Yeah. And we're talking about what's inside the inner horizon.
Oh.
The metric is given by that function f at r, where m is given by that thing, where that gamma is an incomplete error function. So it's never exactly Schwarzschild, but for distances increasingly larger than lambda g, it's very, very close.
Okay.
And as you plow in toward r equals 0, it deviates more and more. First you'll plow through the outer horizon and then through an inner horizon, and there it will really look different, very close.
So this results. It's equivalent to what's been obtained by in publications on non-commutative quantum gravity by Spallucci, Nicolini, Modesto, lots of people. But non-commutative quantum gravity suffers from not being Lorentz ring. And also, when you do Mayow's star product to do non-commutative quantum gravity, you find that you have to truncate the entire function, or whatever it is you have, you modify. And this leads to a non-renormalizable quantum gravity theory. This theory does not have these problems, and yet we're reproducing these very nice results from non-commutative quantum gravity. With a lead scale. We have a lead scale. Yes.
If I understand correctly, if I send lambda g to infinity, I should recover just the usual Einstein.
You recover the usual Schwarzschild solution.
Because if I look at the last line and I send lambda g to infinity, that sends lambda effective to infinity. Doesn't really look like Schwarzschild.
It goes to 1. Well,
no,
it's lambda g is an inverse length.
A little bubble of disorder where the singularity used to be, and although the cosmological constant, the bubble is getting bigger and bigger in the limit, the size of the bubble is getting smaller and smaller. So in the limit, the bubble goes to 0 and disappears.
No, that's just the color.
Is that right?
Just the near r equals 0. The last line is just near r equals 0. Is that the Taylor's function?
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that you found this alternative solution, which is less singular,
right? Not
singular at all. It's not singular at all. But you haven't proved that dynamically you actually approach this solution. And the reason I'm asking that is because we can form a black hole just from gravitational waves, right? We don't need any matter at all. You could just send in a large enough number of gravitational
you have to do the collapse
and
problem.
Then you will, yeah, you have to
which
do
you haven't done.
But then it looks as if, from that equation, you're just dealing exactly with the Einstein.
Because there's no T mu nu collapse. That's his point. Right? So T mu nu, where the S is 0, if you have gravitational waves imploding, that's his point.
Okay, well, in Oppenheimer's light, it collapsed of a real star.
Okay.
You have a T mu
nu
with a rho and a P. Well, P is 0.
It seems that if we take this classical limit seriously that way, then we will have singularities because there are the singularity theorems in the presence of zero stress energy, all the energy conditions are
if you
obeyed.
Have a G
the singularity theorems are obeyed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you send in enough gravitational waves to form a horizon. You get a trapped surface, and it guarantees you a singularity. The only way around that would be to introduce some new stress energy.
This has to do with black holes that are formed by collapsing matter.
I know, but, so, but I'm just saying the theory still has similarities in it.
Gravitational waves, if they collapse, you can still form a singularity. Because there is no team.
Yeah, they will.
But I'm confused by this dispute because I thought that his non-locality was also involved in the gravitons' interactions with each other. It's just how a bunch of gravitons and they have the graviton loop Feynman diagram. The non-locality is still there.
The scattering amplitude is non-local.
It's non-local. So there should be a non-locality in here even apart from any stress energy transfer.
Well, yeah, that's
but it doesn't appear in the equations.
Right, so now the question becomes how come that equation.
That's another one.
Yeah, that's the point.
That's right. But if you do a quantum gravity calculation with this theory, then it would affect everything, all kinds of fixed everything. But this is more work, okay? We're not claiming we've solved everything, but there's a lot of issues that are raised here. So, cosmology, I'll just complete this. Again, you start with this equation here, and this is the FRW metric. These are the Friedman equations. Now, rho sub s is the density involving the entire functions, the non-causal entire functions, non-local entire functions, sorry. And we have these choices for rho. Instead of having the usual equation of state of rho equals one w p, we adopt these equations, these solutions for rho. You have to distinguish between rho and rho sub s. And this one here has a delta function t equal to 0, and otherwise goes like 1 over t squared. The fact that the coefficient 3 is important. So you solve for rho given these, rho sub s given these rhos, and this is what you get. And lambda's the scale, gravitational scale, not the cosmological constant. So this is the answer. This is A of t versus t. A of t is approximately constant along here for t less than 0. And this is our solution, the dashed green, the red curve. This is the green dashed curve is the one just with the delta function of t equals 0. The red curve is the one where you have a 1 over t squared plus the delta function. And here we have inflation. The green dashed curve is the inflation with enough 60 defaults to give you inflation. And this is what we get by integrating the Friedman equations. And the solution goes into the classical radiation dominant solution. There's no infraton field.
Excuse me, John, you can't possibly get inflation because you get to the same point, you get to the same R at the same time with, as you
this
said,
is
the
t.
Classical picture. Yeah, so you never solve the rising problem. That is the R of the R is never bigger after the lines are set. The R is never bigger than it would have been with the normal radiation dominated all the way back to the original singularity. So you never solve the rising problem.
No, but it turns out that you can determine the number of EFOs and inflation.
You have a lot of EFOs because you wait a long time when nothing happens, then you go boom. Well, and you still don't get any further than you would have gotten from a normal evolution. So you don't solve the horizon problem. You don't get R exponentially bigger than T.
No, but you do.
You don't. You go out on the red curve.
Yeah.
So suppose I'm out there at T, that's which is T and which is R?
T is horizontal.
T is horizontal. So go out to T of 15.
Here.
Yeah.
Plus 15.
Plus 15. And you're at some R.
Yeah, but this is the radiation dominant.
Yeah, but you're at the same. But the black, if you continue, is the radiation dominated solution. So your R at T of 15 is no larger than in your solution than had it been the standard radiation dominated solution all the way back to the singularity. So you do eliminate the singularity, but you don't solve the horizon problem.
I think,
I mean, it's interesting to eliminate the singularity, but
you have to solve the horizon problem you have to write down the integral dA over A, okay? And find out whether it diverges or not. Okay, that's what determines whether you have a you solve the horizon.
Well, the vertical axis, it's hard to see color.
The vertical axis is A of T, the cosmic scale.
Yeah, so you don't get an A of T any larger at T greater than the transition point.
But hold on, I don't personally like the word horizon problem, but if you're talking about the question, would the different parts of the universe have had time to be in quantum contact?
Yes.
Isn't there a long initial period where it's just sitting at some fixed size? There's nothing happening. So during that time, it seems to me there would be. Does that plant fit there?
This is the solution.
Yeah, but
you can solve the horizon problem there, but you don't solve the horizon problem because there happens to be. Yes, that's true. If you eliminate the singularity, you have as much time as you like to solve the horizon problem. You're
yes.
Correct.
So you have to go all the way back to minus infinity. There's a long time. This
you
is what's called.
It because it was,
this
it
is called pre.
Like
this is called pre-Big Bang inflation, and this is correct what you said. Okay, so just a few more comments.
Well, can I ask where did the 68 volts come? Did you tune? And why is it? Shouldn't it be 80, 70? Something is.
It depends on.
Is giving you exactly 60?
Yeah, because
what is that?
It depends on the size of this constant C naught. As you increase C0, you produce more of this delta function T equals 0, and you get more and more
inflation. C0 is a parameter in the solution, is that?
C0 is put in by hand.
An integration constant, or is it another parameter in
it's
the
It's a
theory?
Parameter.
And so what does it correspond to? I mean, here you showed us one entire function with one parameter. So what's this C0?
No, but it's to do with the choice of rho. Rho is the density of the corresponds to the usual T in U. Okay.
So can we think of it as kind of integration constant of this theory? There will be different solutions with different values.
Yeah.
Different numbers of equals.
Yeah.
All
I,
the same.
I agree.
So it's like it's something like a choice of an initial matter content or something like
that. That's right. It depends on how singular the because a delta function is not a function, it's a generalized function. So it's the limit
of
a Gaussian.
Rho V means, what is rho V?
Rho is the rho that corresponds to T naught. No. Yeah.
That comes from solving the Friedman equations of Einstein.
No, it's put in by hand.
How could you put it
in? You solve the Friedman equations in GR and FRW, you have to have an equation state because you have too many unknowns compared to equations.
Oh, but this is not an equation of state.
No.
So the question is this any equation of state?
You can derive the equation
in other words,
of state, but it doesn't
have
this
form. You might have a time-varying equation of state.
It doesn't have this form, yeah.
It's not that, but it's rho any function of p. Not necessarily a linear
yeah.
function of p. But is a function of p or a function of p and t?
P.
That's the question. That's okay?
This is not what we use.
That's not it, but... So is P a function of rho alone, or is it a function of rho and T somehow?
If you assume this energy density, you have P, which is the solution of the other equation.
You can derive
the
P.
Rho and T, but then it's not an equation of state.
No.
In the ordinary sense.
Not in the ordinary
sense.
Just
in the energy.
You're saying that the properties of the matter are changing somehow.
That's said by hand. That's the energy density chosen by hand. Is a consequence of this.
If you,
so I could have chosen any other energy density and there are different profiles.
That's right.
But normally in physics, it's the physics of the matter that chooses the energy density. Once
so
you set the initial conditions, then the Einstein.
So the first part of the energy density actually is the radiation dominant energy density. The second part is put there by hand. And the reason is if you want the.
Sorry, is that delta T? Yeah. So it's an energy density which is just there for an instant of time and then disappears.
Yeah.
What kind of physical mechanism produces an energy density? The infinite energy density that comes into being instantly and then immediately disappears
again. Well, what the delta function is doing is sharply the singularity to the zero. It's a singularity is sharper than the 1 over t squared, which is the usual behavior for rho. Rho is always 1 over t squared for radiation dominant or dust solutions from Friedman equations.
Yes, but normally you derive that from the statement that
no,
rho
what you
is
do
equal
is GR, you start with frequency. You start with frequency equations and you solve for A of t.
Yeah, and you use the P as 1/3.
And you use P equal to W rho to do this.
Yes.
So then you have the same number of equations as unknown. So we're turning this around and doing it this way, but it's equivalent to solving the equations correctly.
You could get any profile you want just by using the right rho of t.
Well, we get a solution.
There's some physical limitation on what rho t.
Yeah, we get a solution which becomes the classical solution for the radiation dominant case by choosing that coefficient 3. Choosing 3 is equivalent to choosing the equation state. Okay, so one couple of minutes, if you allow me. So what I've done in my paper on ultraviolet complete quantum gravity is to investigate the cosmological constant problem. We all know what that is. Delta lambda is equal to 8 pi g Newton. All right. And the cosmological constant problem consists of following. You have rho vac root minus g in the reversion. And graph is equal to, if you do root plus g minus, these are all vacuum graphs. And the problem arises because you're coupling the vacuum density to the gravitons. And when I do my vacuum polarization calculations, I have a lambda g, and a lambda g vac, if I choose this to be of order 2 times 10 to the minus 3 eV, then it turns out that I can get rho vac less than order rho m upset, which is the criteria for solving the problem. However, this is all vacuum. However, if you do e plus e minus Rutherford scattering, then this involves atomic physics. Matter is involved in the calculation in addition to this loop here, as opposed to this. This is in pure space vacuum. This is not. Same with Casimir. So I have to have another constant. I call it lambda g matter. And this is greater than 1 MeV. Otherwise, you get into trouble with the equivalence principle, because I'm attaching a graviton here. And you can't decouple all the vacuum energy from gravity, otherwise you violate the equivalence principle for the last shift in hydrogen. So there's a potential solution to the cosmological constant problem in this quantum gravity theory, finite quantum gravity theory. The lambda g is lambda g is a fundamental length energy or inverse length, which is like h. It's a fundamental constant of nature. And all of this is happening because I'm bringing in a fundamental length into the physics. And this is what gives me a way of getting away from ring normalization theory. And this is the case with loop quantum gravity, I believe, and also with non-commutative quantum gravity. The non-commutative quantum gravity has some serious problems. And a lot of those problems are spelled out in a paper I published in 2000 called Non-Commutative Quantum Gravity. Whereas this theory, I believe, gets around the problems of introducing a fundamental length into particle physics and quantum gravity. And finally, in my lecture weight model, I do the same as here, and for example, the unification condition that P equals G psi theta W equals G prime cosine theta W is brought in. I get lecture weight theory without a Higgs, which is finite to all orders. However, I break SU2 cross U1. Only the electromagnetic part is finally breaks into U1 electromagnetic.
Can I ask a question about the relationship of the various things you've just said? So to solve the Gauss module constant, you need, are you saying we need this to introduce more than one length scale now in different sectors of the theory?
Right.
So you'll have a big fuzziness in the graviton coupling in order
pure
to
vacuum.
Save the cosmological constant hierarchy problem, and then you're going to have a much shorter distance scale in particle physics.
Yes. And my particle physics lambda is greater than 2TeV. And I have predictions for cross sections. Above 2TeV, I don't violate the unitarity. I get rid of this unitarity violation in WW and WW scattering. And I predict a cross section above 2TeV, which can be checked against the standard model, Higgs model, so that this theory can be tested, and it will be tested. If it turns out that the coupling constants LHC up at 10TeV, if the coupling constants run like 1 over log, which is the hallmark signature of renormalizable theory. This means that we have to buy into renormalization theory where you have an infinite scaling. And I don't like that because I'm with Paul Dirac. I don't like the renormalization theory. It's based on a fundamental inconsistency. It works amazingly well. But when you write that you normalize the mass in particle physics, this is originally true in Penn State's original paper from 1947-48, which refers to the renormalization calculation. You have to assume that in the calculation, perturbation calculation, the delta M is small. And of course, it's infinite. It's logarithmically divergent when you do the calculations for the electron. And M naught is infinite. So you're canceling two infinities to get the measured mass in. Now this works extraordinarily well. However, I don't like it, okay? For the same reason Dirac doesn't like it. So this is crucial for LHC to find out how the coupling constants run. Because they run when you do the loop calculations and QED and electric weight and QCD, they run like 1 over logs. And you also get Landau poles in the Higgs field, which become dangerous. They become dangerously low in energy, depending on the size of the Higgs mass. The electromagnetic potential in the standard Higgs model has a Landau pole at a very large energy, but still, it's pathological. In my theory about the Higgs, all my vector fields, WZ and the photon, are asymptotically safe. There are no Landau poles in my theory. This is proved in my paper. on my electrolyte model. So if they don't find a Higgs particle, which I don't believe they will, for the reason that no one in the history of accelerator physics since 1933, when Cockcroft and Walton produced the first accelerator, no one's ever seen an elementary scalar field particle with spin zero and positive parity. Never. And they won't do it now, in my opinion. It's a pretty good safe bet. The pion is not an elementary particle.
It could easily be a pion.
It's made of a quark and an antiquity.
A pion could easily be a composite state.
Yes, but a lot of work has been done in composite models, electroweak standard models. For example, Technicolor. But Technicolor, you need a strong force to bind the Technicolor particles to make a Higgs, a composite W in Z. And we don't know how to do strong interaction. Also, you have to invent a lot of new particles around the TEV, Technicolor quarks. And they can find them. And again, if they don't see them, Technicolor is out. Top, anti-top composite models for the Higgs don't work because the top is too hard, it's too heavy. It's 173 GeV. This is a long history. So we'll see with the results of the LHC what the story will be.
So,
thank you.
Stop here. We can thank you.